This is VOA's International Edition. The political temperature rises in Washington over the climate change agreement. A new global campaign launched to eliminate rabies.
When canine rabies goes down, so do human rabies deaths. Mass vaccination is by far more effective and also more humane than rounding up stray dogs and destroying them.
Drone takes out a new meaning in the U.S. college classroom. And excitement builds over the new Star Wars movie, which opens this week. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Americans are digesting a global climate accord that is dividing Washington along predictable partisan political lines. Congressional Democrats flooded Twitter to hail the accord. Not so by Republicans, who announced their opposition even before the deal was struck. But the Obama administration is standing firm, and the accord is sure to spark fierce debate when Congress reconvenes this week. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman about the feelings on Capitol Hill.
2 weeks before Christmas, on a day when it was warm enough in Washington, D.C., where we could all wear short-sleeve shirts.
And some of us are.
And some of us have been all weekend long. It has been unseasonably warm and appropriate of that, Jim. There was indeed an accord announced in Paris, and President Obama made a rare Saturday statement before the cameras to say that this is the realization of a long-held goal of his and his administration to get the nations of the world together on a common concrete plan to stop the warming of the planet. Within seconds, it already ran into the buzzsaw of U.S. domestic politics.
You know, when you say something in this town, there's immediate reaction. And I would imagine it probably came from the Republican end of the scale.
Indeed. Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican Majority Leader, came out with a statement pointing out that America's adherence to this, America's contribution to this reduction in carbon emissions is all based on President Obama's domestic initiatives to rein in the burning of coal, to make cars more fuel efficient, and basically President Obama's entire domestic environmental agenda, which the Republicans have been fighting tooth and nail, particularly on the energy front. Taking the Obama administration to court, there are new regulations that are coming out, and Mitch McConnell points out that these are being contested domestically. And depending on how the courts rule and how this plays out, what Mr. Obama has pledged or what his administration has pledged in Paris might not come about. You have to understand that an accord like this is not a treaty. When the United States was negotiating nuclear treaties with the old Soviet Union, those were put before the Senate. They were ratified. This is more of an executive agreement type thing, which means that Mr. Obama doesn't have to submit it to Congress for anyone's approval, but it also means that whoever comes into the White House in 2017 can rip it up or can continue to adhere to this. So we are seeing yet another issue on which next year's presidential election could hinge.
The United States actually has a fairly long history now of environmental change through regulation. From the very first Earth Day back in 1970, we've seen dramatic changes in legislation. And, you know, I seem to recall periods of great economic boom in the United States from 1970 to now. Sure, we've had our downturns, but it seems to me that has had a pretty successful history so far.
Well, President Obama would point out that not only that, but that there are new economic opportunities to be seized in a clean energy future. Indeed, the United States has shrunk the rate of acceleration for carbon emissions. And I believe this year may actually have leveled off or started to decline ever so slightly. Many environmentalists point out that one of the simplest and easiest things that any government can do is simply to mandate better fuel economy for vehicles. These more fuel efficient cars would not be available in the numbers that they are available today were it not for government regulations telling car makers, domestic and foreign, if you want to sell cars, a certain number has to get a certain mileage.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. The climate agreement, adopted by more than 190 nations, aims to keep global temperature increases below 2 degrees Celsius, provide $100 billion in climate investment to poorer countries, review progress every 5 years, and peak carbon emissions as soon as possible. One key issue not addressed in the agreement is how richer countries and poorer countries should divide up responsibility to pay for climate change programs. The climate agreement is getting a great deal of reaction online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about what's being said. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. There's a lot going on Twitter about the importance of the agreement approved last weekend, so without further ado, let's start from the top. President Barack Obama is on Twitter, at POTUS. He tweeted this earlier Sunday. The strong Paris Agreement on climate means a safer, more secure world for our kids. A perfect example of what American leadership can do. The White House's Twitter account, at White House, is usually much more active than the president's own account, and Sunday was not an exception. The White House sent out this tweet quoting the president. This agreement will mean less of the carbon pollution that threatens our planet. It retweeted a couple of tweets from Facts on Climate, an account run by the presidential office. The White House also shared tweets from Vice President Joe Biden and Secretary of State John Kerry. Biden tweeted, "The Paris Agreement will improve the world our kids and grandkids will grow old in." And Kerry wrote, "World has chosen a smart, responsible path forward, and that the agreement is the strongest, most ambitious global climate agreement ever negotiated."
It is certainly a historic move for sure, whether people like it or not. So what else is buzzing online?
There's another U.S. politician who is getting just as much, if not more, attention on the web. But in this case, it's for calling a Saudi Arabian prince, quote-unquote, dopey on social media. For international listeners, I want to explain that the word means being stupefied by sleep or a drug or being idiotic. GOP presidential hopeful Donald Trump tweeted this. Dopey prince at Al-Walid Talal wants to control our U.S. politicians with daddy's money. Can't do it when I get elected. That tweet got more than twice the number of retweets than President Obama's tweet on the Paris Agreement. He was responding to the Saudi billionaire's tweet that reads like this. At real Donald Trump, you are a disgrace not only to the GOP, but to all America. Withdraw from the U.S. presidential race as you'll never win. Fun fact, Talal was actually the one who hoovered up Trump's assets when the American billionaire ran into money problems back in the 1990s. Ray?
Thank you, G. You can follow us on Twitter and offer your reaction at VOA underscore IE. And G is on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Childhood experts say children are not spared from the effects of climate change. Many are especially impacted by food scarcity and disease brought about by rising temperatures. VOA's Jessica Berman has details.
Young children need adequate nutrition to grow. They cannot get enough when crops wither in excess heat as water sources become scarce. The nutrient value of key crops, including wheat, rice, and barley, also declines.
Children in developing countries where they are already at risk of malnutrition are at particularly high risk.
In a policy statement for the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Samantha Adut warns children face harm from climate change. This is the second time in 8 years the group has sounded the alarm.
The World Health Organization this year determined that compared to a future with no climate change, an additional 95,000 child deaths due to malnutrition and an additional 7.5 million moderate or severely stunted, growth-stunted children are projected for the year 2030.
Youngsters are also more vulnerable to heat exhaustion and stroke. Mortality caused by elevated temperatures is expected to rise by 5.5% for female children and 7.8% for males by the end of the century. The frequency of disease is also expected to climb, as disease-carrying mosquitoes and parasites thrive in warming temperatures, increasing malaria, dengue fever, chikungunya, and diarrheal illnesses. Adut says children are at particular risk as a result of rising global temperatures.
Children's unique needs place them at risk of injury or death, and loss of or separation from caregivers, as well as mental health consequences due to severe weather events. For example, after Hurricane Katrina, more than 5,000 children were separated from their families, and 163,000 children were displaced by the hurricane, either temporarily or permanently.
Adut says the policy statement published in Pediatrics, the Academy's flagship magazine, was not written to coincide with the December World Climate Summit in Paris. Rather, she says, the statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics reflects the findings of thousands of studies of the health effects of global warming on children. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Aid agencies are warning that a whole generation of Syrian children is being mentally scarred by the conflict at home and by the difficulties of life as a refugee. Charities say treatment for traumatized children is vastly underfunded. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Playing with his three brothers in their small apartment in Lebanon, 9-year-old Aidan is sometimes able to forget the horrors he witnessed in Syria. But the nightmares often return, and the psychological scars are being compounded by the misery of life as a refugee. Aidan says that other children speak to him in a very bad way, using bad words. He says they point at him and call him a Syrian dog and accuse Syrians of causing bombs. Aid agency Save the Children warns that a catastrophic number of Syrian children is bearing the mental scars of war and displacement and being left untreated. Caroline Anning, who works for the charity, spoke to VOA via Skype from Lebanon.
I spoke to a child yesterday, a six-year-old girl, who'd lost her eye in an explosion in an airstrike in Homs on her house, and she'd seen her younger brother torn to pieces in front of her. And children are very resilient, but those kind of things are incredibly difficult to get past, and particularly without expert help and psychological care.
That expert care is being provided by some groups like Save the Children, who run a so-called child-friendly space in the Lebanese city of Tripoli, where Syrian and Lebanese families can integrate in a safe area. Child psychologist Reem Nasri of Save the Children says more resources and funding are desperately needed.
Leaving a child untreated can lead to very negative impact later on in adulthood. For example, they can become very aggressive later on, and there's also a very deep emotional impact that can occur, which can lead to, for example, depression, anxiety problems, even phobia, which can be very difficult to treat later on.
The statistics are striking. In a refugee camp in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, 1 in 10 children has lost at least one parent. An estimated 200,000 Syrian refugee children are growing up with no form of education. Rates of early marriage for girls are soaring. Again, Caroline Anning.
There's 2 million Syrian refugee children. And at the moment, the funding for child protection, which is what this sort of thing, this kind of help comes under, is only 26% funded.
Anning says a whole generation of Syrian children is being scarred by the horrors of war, and intervention is needed fast. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The World Health Organization and World Organization for Animal Health are launching a global campaign to eliminate rabies by 2030. The two agencies say tens of thousands of lives can be saved every year by eliminating this vaccine-preventable disease. Lisa Schlein has more in Geneva.
People love their dogs, and in most cases, dogs provide loving companionship for people throughout the world. Unfortunately, dogs are the main carriers of rabies, a disease that kills more than 70,000 people worldwide each year, most of them children. The World Health Organization says about 80% of people exposed to rabies live in poor rural areas of Africa and Asia with no access to prompt treatment should they be bitten. Rabies is the world's deadliest disease, killing 99% of its victims. WHO Director General Margaret Chan calls this an irretrievable and unnecessary loss, as rabies can be prevented by vaccinating dogs against this disease.
Vaccinating at least 70% of the dog population breaks the cycle of transmission in dogs. When canine rabies goes down, so do human rabies deaths. Mass vaccination is by far more effective and also more humane than rounding up stray dogs and destroying them.
Mass vaccination campaigns also are more cost-effective. WHO estimates a dog vaccine costs less than $1, whereas the cost of treating people who are bitten is between $40 and $50. This represents, on average, 40 days of wages in some affected countries in Africa and Asia. Bernard Vallat, Director General of the World Organization for Animal Health, says besides endangering the lives of humans, rabid dogs also pose a threat for endangered wildlife. He tells VOA rabid dogs in Africa often penetrate protected animal reserves and infect buffalo, antelopes, wild dogs, and other vulnerable wildlife.
So controlling rabies in dogs will lead also to save some endangered species, particularly in Africa, is a good argument also to be developed for promoting dog vaccination.
Health experts agree a comprehensive and coordinated national approach is needed to run a successful mass dog vaccination campaign. For best results, they say, governments must involve veterinarians in the private sector and local communities who, after all, know the people who own the dogs that could become rabid if neglected and not vaccinated. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, drones go to college. This is VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is considering a recommendation to require almost all consumer drones weighing a quarter kilo or more to be registered with the government. Colleges and universities around the United States are recognizing that unmanned aircraft could become a key technology of the future. They are responding with courses to train a new generation of drone pilots and engineers. Tom Bonsi has more from the Northwest U.S. city of Seattle, Washington.
How cool is this? A lab class where the homework includes building robotic vehicles from scratch.
So once it's armed, you can throttle up.
16 students have gathered around a long conference table at the University of Washington in Seattle with aeronautics research scientist Christopher Lum.
Great. Okay. So it's controllable and it's great. That's half the battle then.
A student holds down the small drone with his fingers to keep it from lifting off which makes Lum nervous.
Tell you what, let's cut. This doesn't look super safe right now, the way we've got the protocol set up.
Students at the UW's Autonomous Flight Systems Laboratory are working on how civilian drones can safely share the skies with manned aircraft. Senior Ryan Volek savors his 3 years in the lab.
One of the coolest parts is the collaboration we get to do with industries and all the cool technology we get to work with. It's definitely an opportunity that a lot of students don't usually get.
Aeronautics and astronautics master's student Ward Handley wasn't as sold at first.
I specifically decided, no, I do not want to work on drones because of the privacy issues.
But then came an offer for a paid position in a drone lab, and Handley had a transformation.
I'd like to see them used for good rather than ill. I think there are enough good applications for them that are really useful to society so that it is worthwhile to pursue these things.
Recognizing the potential good and ill of drones, the Federal Aviation Administration selected 15 universities to be part of a national academic research consortium. It's called the Center of Excellence for Unmanned Aircraft Systems. This comes with federal grant funding to expand research and training. On top of that, at least several dozen community colleges are offering vocational drone operator courses. It's possible now to get an associate degree or a bachelor's degree in unmanned aircraft systems operations. A challenge for many academic unmanned aerial systems programs is finding a place to fly legally. At Blue Mountain Community College in Pendleton, Oregon, students fly inside the college gym. UW student Alec Buing in Seattle showed me his department's flight test range for small copters.
Just a conference room that we move the tables and chairs out of the way for. Make sure to bring the blinds down so if it happens to get out of control towards the windows, we minimize any damage.
Why indoors? Lum says it takes a very long time for everyone besides hobbyists to get official permission to fly a drone outside.
The federal regulations are a little bit stifling on that front. We need to file for paperwork. We need to register our aircraft. We need to obtain what's called a certificate of authorization or waiver.
All of which take months. That's why Lum says he and some of his students have relocated to more accommodating Australia for the past 2 summers to log flying time. A Western Washington University professor took his department's 2 drones across the border to Canada for the same reason. The prospects for graduates in this field look good. A bunch of the seniors I met in Seattle were getting invitations to job interviews long before graduation. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Moviegoers are anxiously awaiting this week's opening of the latest Star Wars film, Episode 7, The Force Awakens. The entertainment industry is speculating it could be the highest-grossing film of all time. Star Wars fans have been camped out at an iconic Hollywood landmark up to 12 days before the upcoming December 17th release. VOA's Kane Farabaugh checked out the line where 130 fans were already waiting, and I talked with him about their anticipation and excitement.
The interesting part about this is the people who are actually waiting in line don't have to wait in line to go see the movie. As a matter of fact, if you're waiting in line hoping to get a ticket, chances are you're not going to see the movie on opening night because all of the tickets at that theater and in many theaters across the country sold out by advanced ticket sales when they went on sale in October. So there's a group called lineingup.net which bought 500 tickets for the opening night screenings there at the Chinese theater. And if you wait in line with a lot of these other Star Wars fans, you have to do so for at least 24 accumulated hours. And if you do, you'll get one of the tickets that this group bought to get in to see the first shows at the Mann's Chinese Theater, or now called the TCL Chinese Theater. So really, the sense of it all is just camaraderie. These Star Wars fans are passionate people who, you know, enjoyed these movies. It's kind of harkens back to their childhood. And so I guess the visceral experience of waiting in line with other hardcore Star Wars fans is appealing to a lot of people, and you can definitely see it in line. They're wearing costumes, you know, they're playing with toys, they've got lightsabers with them. I mean, it's basically like you're stepping into Halloween filled with people dressed in Star Wars characters and costumes, and they're all just excited really just to be there in advance of the film.
Is there any kind of significant age range for these fans?
Many of the people I spoke to who were waiting in line are actually in their 40s and 50s. These are people who probably have a connection to the film because they saw it when they were kids in the 1970s. And so in some sense, you know, the original characters from the original films are coming back in this movie. So the reason why you're seeing that age group there is because these are people kind of reliving their childhood in a way. You know, but some of those folks have kids, and while they're not going to make their kids miss school to wait in the line, they're waiting in the line, and their kids or family members might join them. But anybody who's in that line that wants to get one of those tickets has got to put in the hours. So for some, it's a family affair. For others, it's just an expression of their love for Star Wars.
Did you come across anyone online that had done this previously?
As a matter of fact, most of the people that were waiting there have done it for the other films. This was something that really started in 2002 during the release of Episode II, Attack of the Clones. Even though it's Episode II, you know how these things go. It's the prequel trilogy, so it was really the fifth film in the series. And so a lot of them were there in 2002, and they formed relationships, friendships, bonds. And so what started in 2002 carried over to the next film in 2005, and it's now carried over to this film in 2015.
How much do the tickets go for those who are waiting in line?
For them, actually, they have to make a donation to a charity. In this instance, it's the Starlight Foundation, in order to sign up online. I guess what happens is that should you make a donation to that charity and wait in line for the time, you've entitled yourself to get one of the tickets that they've reserved. So I guess the cost varies according to how much they're donating to the charity. But the real cost for them, I think, is time. You know, you got to wait that time in line in order to get a ticket.
VOA's Kane Faribault, who is a big Star Wars fan himself. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, features, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Saban Forum in Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry said the focus of U.S. policy in the Middle East is to help ensure that the builders and the healers throughout the region have the chance that they need to accomplish their tasks. Among key issues, Mr. Kerry pointed to progress being made toward a political solution to the Syrian war, which, if successful, would make possible a stronger and more unified assault on Daesh and other violent extremists. He also highlighted the critical need for Israeli and Palestinian leaders to break the current impasse and focus on working through the difficulties hindering the only viable option for peace between the Israeli and Palestinian peoples, a two-state solution that can afford security and prosperity for both. The United States, said Mr. Kerry, will be with them every step of the way to support them in that effort. Additionally, for the builders in the region to have the opportunity to succeed, it is imperative, Secretary Kerry said, that they be shielded as much as possible from the sources of imminent and potential danger. That is why the nuclear deal agreed to by the European Union, the P5+1 countries, and Iran is so important. 2 years ago, when formal negotiations with Iran began, Iran had 19,000 centrifuges. It had a stockpile of enriched uranium, and it was building a heavy water reactor able to produce enough weapons-grade plutonium for a bomb. If it chose to, Secretary Kerry said, Iran could obtain all of the fissile material needed for a nuclear weapon in as little as 2 months.
Under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, every single one of Iran's pathways to a bomb is blocked. Its uranium pathway, its plutonium pathway, its covert pathway. And because of the unprecedented monitoring and verification requirements that we negotiated, which are an integral part of this plan, we now have 25 years of day-to-day complete visibility on every ounce of uranium that is mined. We track it.
Secretary Kerry said the nuclear deal with Iran was considered on its own terms, not as part of speculation that Iran would make a shift in its destructive behavior in other areas. It was the right thing to do, he said, because any effort to roll back Iran's behavior is a lot easier if they don't have a nuclear weapon.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.